the University of Washington Computer Science and Engineering Distinguished Lecture Series.
I want to welcome you to Computer Science and Engineering Distinguished Lecture, this time offered jointly with the UW Data Science Seminar. Hopefully many of you heard John Kleinberg's first talk in the Data Science Seminar yesterday. So it's a real pleasure to welcome him here to the University of Washington once again and to thank him for spending two full days with us. It's been really invigorating. John Kleinberg is a luminary of the field of computer science and computational social science. He, at a tender age, is a member of the National Academy of Engineering and the National Academy of Sciences. There are very few people of any age in our field who have that distinction. Longtime faculty member at Cornell. He even persuaded them to hire his kid brother. That's been quite an accomplishment. So they are overstocked with Kleinbergs. And he really has been a pioneer in computational social network analysis. It's just been a revolutionary way to think about the networks that are parts of our lives. So without further ado, help me welcome John Kleinberg. Thanks for being
Thanks.
Here.
Thanks a lot. All right, great, thanks very much. Can everyone hear back there? That's good? Good, okay. Thanks Ed for that nice introduction. It's been great getting to spend a couple days here and just, you know, meeting with both people whose work I've followed for a long time, as well as some new people who I'm just getting to meet. But just, I mean, the amount of work going on here that I follow and admire and am influenced by is huge. So it's always great to get to visit University of Washington. So I started my talk yesterday by noting that I first gave a talk here in 2001, really when the sort of the web and all the movement of information and social activity onto the internet was really at a much younger stage. And over the time since I first visited here, there's really been this movement toward, you know, people sort of interacting much more directly online with these systems, having this kind of subtle element of design in the background. And I want to explore this theme a bit further, particularly in the way that incentives get introduced in these systems. And I'll hope to kind of move from, you know, starting with the online world, but eventually think about some of the incentives get subtly introduced into our offline environments also. So among all these various systems, one thing that's, I think, standing out in a lot of them is the way in which people are not just interacting with them in a kind of one-off or short-term way, but where people have these sort of very long, visible, and virtual lifetimes on these systems. And they set long-range goals for themselves, right? So an editor on Wikipedia, after they've logged 10,000 edits, might, for example, go up, you know, for promotion to an admin position on Wikipedia, something which actually requires sort of submitting your Wikipedia CV effectively and going through what looks like a sort of 10-year review and promotion process. Right? Someone in the Khan Academy or any kind of online course or a MOOC might set goals to, you know, achieve certain things. Stack Overflow similarly has a long-range reputation systems, which I'll get back to. And of course, you know, long-range planning is something where, you know, think that, which is something that we all do in our everyday lives, it's really been moving into the online domain. So, as you know, when people design systems, the question is how do you steer that kind of long-range planning, right? Rather than creating incentives for you just in the moment, I may want to set up force fields that cause you to do certain things over much longer periods of time. So there are lots of ways to do that, but one that's kind of come on really fast in the last 2-3 years is the use of badges, right? These sort of virtual rewards, virtual insignia that say, if you do a certain amount of a certain kind of activity, you will get this, you know, this recognition, this badge, this indication of some sort. You know, so we see this, you know, Stack Overflow, big use of badges, Foursquare, very early adopter of badges, you know, open badge frameworks, seeing them in online education. And the funny thing about badges is they're at once sort of very simple to talk about, but they're also actually quite complicated in the behaviors that they induce, right? And something interesting always happens when you have these very simply expressed primitives that induce very complex behaviors. First of all, badges are kind of multifarious, right? In the sense that when I offer you a badge or offer you the prospect of getting a badge, I'm doing several things. One is it'll recognize that you're a, you know, skilled, high-achieving member of the community, but it also creates an incentive on you to try achieving that landmark. And because there are all these different things, I'll be thinking much more about the incentive systems, but because there are these sort of different dimensions, a lot of different frameworks have been employed for reasoning about badge systems, right? Ranging from, you know, social psychological things, as in this influential work of Jodi and Liz Churchill, my own colleagues David Easley and Arpita Ghosh, thinking about game theoretic methods, alums of your, quite distinguished alums of your program, like Jason Hartline, thinking about sort of auction-based based methods for doing this. mean, badges are just sort of one kind of incentive, but I'll start with badges because they're simple to talk about, and then I'll try to sort of open outward from there and think about some of what's going on. Badges, of course, also exist in the offline world. That's an array of military medals, right? We see, you know, in education, we strive for long-range goals in the government and the military. You know, we in science are not immune from this, and actually I'll come back to that. You know, in science, we also strive for badges, you know, so we want to get our papers accepted to prestigious venues. We want things that will have no direct impact necessarily, or, you know, a weak impact on our monetary compensation, but clearly have outsized effects on the things we strive for. And again, you know, it's really in this context that we think of the online badges as really existing in that whole space. Okay, so again, I don't want to put too much weight on badges. They're one way of implementing these kind of incentives, not in the moment, but for this kind of long-range planning. And so with that in mind, here's a kind of three-part outline, and I'll try to sort of hit on all three of these different topics. First, I'll stick with badges and talk about some work that I did with my colleague Dan Huttenlocher at Cornell, our former postdoc now, very successful Stanford faculty member Yuri Leskovich, and his student Ashton Anderson. So basically looking at sort of a model of how people work toward badges and looking at some of those effects on Stack Overflow. Then also we'll sort of take what we learn from badges on Stack Overflow and think about trying to build theoretical models of two aspects of it. The first is just this idea of long-range planning, right? How is it that people actually plan for the future? In part one, we'll start with a very simple classical model of planning for the future. But we'll talk about some of the ways in which that breaks down and try to import ideas from behavioral economics, particularly the idea of time inconsistency, to think about the more subtle ways in which people plan. And here I'll pose what I think are some interesting theoretical open questions. It's a nice further open meta question to relate that back to some of the data sets that we worked with in part one, but I'll stick with the theoretical questions here. And then finally, as promised, I'll turn this on to science. The second strand of this, the ways in which incentives can torque behavior in interesting ways, and sort of talk about actually one of the first things which I thought about in the space, again, jointly with my former student, Sigal Loren, sort of a response to how we can use some of these ideas of game theory and incentives to understand some of what people have perceived as pathologies in the scientific community and how people work and stuff. All right, so that's the plan. We'll start with this first one, which is sort of a nice self-contained thing, how we looked at Stack Overflow and what happened, and then fork off these two themes, long-range planning as an issue in itself, and incentives and how they steer behavior. Okay, so we looked at badges on Stack Overflow. So Stack Overflow, we should talk a little bit about that. So lots of you know and use Stack Overflow, I'm sure. I certainly have used it. It's kind of, instead of actually having learned Python, my Python programming consists of a long series of Stack Overflow lookups, basically. And so, you know, here's what a Stack Overflow page looks like for those of you who haven't used it. Someone has a question. How should I compute connected components in a graph with 100 million nodes? You know, a nice question. And then a whole bunch of people propose answers to it. I've shown you one, but they could scroll down and there are a bunch of them. Now, I'd like to point out sort of four activities you can do on Stack Overflow. I mean, there are many things that you can study here. I'm going to try to zero in on the ones relevant for us. The first is I can ask a question, like that one there. I can answer a question. And I can also vote. I can upvote the answer. I can say, oh, I like that answer. I, as a third party user, am going to come in. I'm going to vote on that answer and say it's a good answer. And the fourth thing I could do is I could come and I could upvote the question. Now, upvoting the question is maybe the one of these four that you're least aware of when you look at Stack Overflow. It's actually important for them, though, because they actually think of themselves as sort of serving this dual role. They help people answer their questions at the moment they happen. But equally importantly, they help people like me who need to know, you know, how to invert a list in Python or something. I'm going to show up a year after that question was asked. But it's created this knowledge resource that's accessible through search, and you end up landing on this page. And if you know how to upvote the questions, you know how to prioritize them. So these are a bunch of activities that you can do on Stack Overflow. And if you think about yourself as a Stack Overflow user, you're dividing your time between these things. You know, you ask questions, you answer questions, you upvote, you downvote, and of course you get on with the rest of your life that exists outside Stack Overflow. That's important because that's the full set of activities. That's the pie chart of how you're spending your time, some of it on the site, some of it not. Okay, what do you want to do as a designer of this site? Well, I would like to achieve a certain frequency of activities, right? So imagine in this sort of abstract world that I, as the designer of Stack Overflow, want a certain balance of activities. I want a certain amount of asking, answering, voting, and so forth. And certain of these things might be underrepresented. So for example, in the concrete instance here, there was, you know, maybe less voting on questions than we would have liked. So we like more voting because we need that metadata. And people like asking and answering, but voting is just this kind of civic duty you have to do that people don't do. What is under my control? Well, I can create, you know, I can't directly tell people what to do, but I can try to create incentives that steer their behavior. I can create badges. And so what's happening is the user's now going to trade off between two things. They're going to trade off between what they wanted to do and their desire to get the badge. And so you're introducing sort of force fields into this. This notion that I'm going to sort of strive for long-range activities, the badge is set up, we can now also imagine sort of an incentive being created. And that's something that we're going to think about. Now, I'll mention sort of two things that got our intuition going here. One was, we sort of did some initial, Ashton, Yuri, Dan, and I were doing some initial exploratory data analysis of this. And we were watching people's trajectories through Stack Overflow, their life histories. And we got to these weird points where, like, people would sort of begin to sort of curve through this space of activities. It almost was like space was being warped by some big gravitating body there. And when we looked in that part of the space, there was a badge. It was kind of altering their behavior. And we thought, OK, we're going to be on the right track if we can make a model where people are flowing through the system and they're being sort of deflected as they get near badges. That seems to be what's happening intuitively, right? So we'd like a model that somehow, as simply as possible, recreates that idea that I put in a badge, you know, and I'm going to sort of mix kind of three different physics metaphors here, but right, you know, sort of, it's going to sort of, everything's going to sort of line up with the flow lines created by that badge. Okay, and so that's sort of what we're thinking about. All right, so how would we build a model of this? And I'm just going to sort of run through, you know, what this model looked like and what happened sort of on the way to think about the issues that this suggests. Okay, so some ingredients. Here's going to be the model in one slide. I'll introduce a bit of notation as I go, and then we'll pop back up and sort of talk more qualitatively about it. For one slide, let's just delve into what a model like this would look like. So think about, I'm on the site, and I have some action types that I could do. You know, A1 is asking a question, A2 is answering a question, A3 is voting on an answer, whatever. For pedagogical reasons, maybe I just have these two action types in my picture. So the user state is n-dimensional. The user has a preferred distribution over action types, meaning when I decide what to do next, I'm going to flip a biased coin and choose one of these actions, and I'm going to do it next. That's a modeling choice. You could say, why aren't they deterministically choosing? Stuff gets actually messier then. So let's imagine I have a preferred distribution. At any given point in time, I'm just going to randomly select from it. And there's another probability going on, which is that, you know, there's some exogenous force. Like, if I believed I would live forever, then eventually I'll just get around to doing everything, and then there'd be no pressure on me, like, whatever, you know. But our lifetimes are finite, and I realize I'm going to eventually leave the site because maybe I'll get a job that's less boring, and so I won't need, you know, to answer Stack Overflow questions, or maybe I'll get busy for some other reason, or I'll find a better site. I might just leave before I ever get the badge. And so if the badge is way off in the future, it kind of matters less to me because it is way out there. So that's what someone's history looks like on my imagined model site here. It's sort of like a little video game player who just kind of moves up and to the right randomly, right? When they, you know, they draw from P and they either move to the right or they move up and they just kind of do that staircase walk, and eventually with probably delta each step, they just evaporate and they're gone. That's what someone's lifetime looks like. Okay, fine. What do I get to do? I get to introduce badges. So a badge, I'll say, is a monotone subset of the state space, which just means once you're into the subset, you're permanently in the subset. So for example, everything to the right of that blue line is a badge, right? So if you cross the blue line, you now have the blue badge. And you'll have the blue badge forever, and whatever abstract value that confers on you, V sub B, you've got that. I'll come back to the question of why are these badges conferring value, which is, of course, a very interesting question. But for the model, we're just going to axiomatize the conferred value. The red badge is that horizontal line. If you get above the horizontal line, right, so basically the blue badge says, take 10 actions of type 1, you'll get the blue badge. The red badge says, take 5 actions of type 2, you'll get the red badge. And these are now goals you might see for yourself. Okay, since you like the badges, but you also like doing what you want to do, you now face a choice. You don't have to use your preferred distribution P over actions. You could pick a different one, maybe in which you vote and exercise your civic duty more frequently than you would like to because you want that badge. Right? What would that look like? Well, I would say you can pick some other distribution, X, to get the badge more quickly. That comes at a cost, because if you pick one that's very different from what you want to do, you sort of pay a penalty for not doing what you really want to be doing. So there's this cost, G of XP. All right, I think I've now actually written down, this is the fundamental trade-off. You want badges, but you want to do what you natively want to do, namely distribution P. What does that optimization problem look like? Well, actually, so for those of you who've thought about dynamic programming algorithms recently, this is sort of setting itself up as a very natural dynamic program. In fact, in a sense, if you thought about Markov decision processes, at some level, I've built a Markov decision process here, although it's not worth doing the exact mapping to that formalism, because this is relatively self-contained. But it's basically saying that in every state A in this grid, I'm choosing a distribution. It can be different in every state to optimize my expected utility going forward into the future. And what is my expected utility? And this will be sort of the longest equation I write here, and then we'll pop back up. Well, I have a term for all the badges I've won. I pay a penalty for the cost of not doing what I wanted to be doing. And then recursively into the future, with probably 1 minus delta, I live to play one more round. And if I play one more round, I'm going to be in some distribution over next states, which I've recursively computed. Now, there's a little bit of drama involved in solving this dynamic program, because if you think about dynamic programs, what do you want to do? You want to initialize the base case and then start applying this inductive thing going upward. My problem is that my induction is actually going backwards, because if you think about projecting into the future, my current value is dependent on future values, and that goes on infinitely because I could, in principle, live forever. So we need to be a little careful and apply some fixed point reasoning here, but it's not actually that hard to work out, and so we can actually solve this. And so we thought to ourselves, again, you know, the hope would be to say P, you know, P is actually this little orientation vector that I'm selecting from. And again, if we're on the right track, we should see that like people are starting to steer toward badges. You know, as they sort of see the badge coming, they sort of feel it more strongly. They might steer toward it. Yeah.
Why isn't optimum always deterministic?
So the optimum, it depends what the form of G is, for example. But if I put some simple convex G on this, then because P is a distribution, you actually end up mixing. Right, because P is a mixture. Right, because your preferred thing is a mixture. And that's sort of why it's important. Otherwise, as a modeling device, this turns out to work well. If I made it deterministic, you would follow these weird rectilinear lines. We'd go straight for one badge and then straight for another badge, which somehow is, yeah. A different way to say it would be that you satiate on activities. You don't want to do the same activity, so I have a kind of diminishing returns for doing the same activity over and over. That'd be a messier way to model it. This somehow seems to get the same thing. Good question. Okay, so we can solve this. And it basically says for each one, we're going to have a little vector pointing, like, here's how I'm going to behave at every state. So I'll solve a simple example here with just some made-up parameters. And indeed, it sort of looked the way we wanted it to, right? So these are the flow lines through the space. Here are two badges. And I'm starting, you know, so first of all, if you want to figure out what I actually want to be doing, you should look at my behavior after there are no more badges to win. Because at that point, you've lost all control over my behavior. I'm just going to do what I want to do. Until then, and so at the beginning, you notice I'm sort of parallel to the flow line to the end. Because the badges are far away, I'm like, the chance I'm ever going to win a badge is pretty low. So I'm just doing this. And again, I'll describe intuitively the reasoning, but the reasoning is just carried out by a dynamic programming that's optimizing, right? It's not actually thinking any of this. So, but these things are far away. So that 1 minus delta to some high power, you're not really going to get there. But if you start accidentally drifting this way, suddenly you start feeling that badge. That badge has a much higher value to you because there's a much better chance you're actually going to reach it. So you start steering more and more aggressively to hit it. Of course, once you've done that, now the other badge remains to be found. And so it really is like these badges have set up these sort of, you know, charged plates, gravitating bodies, pick your favorite physical metaphor, and they're really sort of, you know, all the iron filings are kind of lining up with that flow. It's sort of what we wanted. Now, it's interesting, I mentioned on an earlier slide, although didn't actually talk about it, the goal gradient hypothesis, which is a notion for psychology that people want closure in the actions they take. So as you see the end coming, a sense of closure means you're going to sort of speed up and try doing it. This, on the other hand, is sort of not making any psychological assumptions. It's saying rational optimizers would also do this kind of like start speeding up as the end is in sight. They differ in their prediction of what's going to happen afterwards. Because notice, the instant I get the badge, I just reset. I say, OK, I've got that badge. Versus maybe I kind of learned to like voting. So after I got the badge, you know, I kind of like this voting thing. I'll keep voting. There we could go to the data. And so we could ask a couple questions. One is, in the data, do we actually see you speeding up as you approach the badge? And what do we see right after you win the badge? OK, so let's look at sort of one thing at a time. So this is a synthetic example. If I just project my two-dimensional picture onto one dimension, this is, say, a badge on A1 causes you to ramp up your amount of A1 actions and sort of ramp down everything else as you approach the badge boundary. Let's look at actual Stack Overflow data. So for sort of exposition here, I'll pick two. These are the main two we looked at, really. Two cumulative badges on Stack Overflow. If you vote either on questions or answers 300 times, you will get the Civic Duty badge. An even harder badge to get is if you vote on at least 600 questions, you will get the electorate badge, which is a harder badge to get and sort of correspondingly a little more prestigious. OK, so we have this five-dimensional state space. You can ask a question, answer a question, vote on a question, vote on the answer, or just do an offsite activity. OK, and here's what this looks like. So I'm going to show you time axis here is how far you are from winning the badge, and the y-axis is how much of each of those activities. So it's sort of mapped onto this kind of color scheme. And here's what we see. So civic duty badge, actually we're measuring this in days rather than actions, although the same, it would be the same either way, really. Civic duty, we see that as you approach the badge, you're just radically ramping up, especially at the very end, both your question voting and your answer voting, right? So if you were to just look at this and say, what is being rewarded here, you would see it's the, you know, some disjunction of question votes and answer votes, because that's really what's, whereas the other two, asking and answering, is just kind of passing straight through that badge boundary unaffected, because that's not what's being rewarded. And the other interesting thing is that the instant you get the badge, well, not the instant, but it starts falling off really fast, right? It goes off a cliff after you've collected the badge. Question voting less so, because of course there's one more thing to win, which is the electorate badge. The electorate badge introduces this gigantic deflection on your question voting. I mean, it just goes way up, and then really falls off a cliff afterwards, right? You've got the, you finally have the electorate badge, you're done, you're back to your reset on voting for questions. There are some other things that we're trying to tease out of this. Like, if you were to ask, like, when you do this, what do you steal activity from? Obviously, partly from the rest of your life, because you're not really dropping much else off. But a little bit on the answer voting, right? So it's sort of an interesting question. You're like, are you sort of mentally categorizing question voting and answer voting together? And so if I have to vote more on questions, I'm gonna vote less on answers. Not clear from the data. Okay, so this is saying that, you know, there is this kind of right at the boundary. It's ramping up and it's falling off very sharply. And one can build a simple model, right? One doesn't need to sort of delve into the psychology of people's behavior so much as just even a simple model of optimization would do that. It also suggests some interesting algorithmic problems that we started to think about. And let me just mention one here and then talk about a little bit of extra experimentation we did. So the interesting question is, suppose I'm a bad, let's just ask the question that we asked qualitatively at the beginning, let's ask it formally. I have one of these state-space systems, which are the actions you could do on the site. I have a desired distribution over actions, which I'll call Q, which is maybe different from any one person's preferred distribution. I'm allowed to define a single badge of value VB, and I want to create an action distribution as close to Q as possible. How should I define the badge? Right, I could say, put the badge, you know, create the blue badge or the red badge, or create something which involves the sum of the actions. I can create any monotone badge I want, and each of them will create a particular overall distribution on actions. Right? And so there's an interesting optimization problem. We've thought a little bit, you know, so an interesting special case, for example, is if my one badge can just be a milestone on action of type one. So it's gonna be a vertical blue badge. I just have to figure out where to put it. There's an interesting sort of, and my goal is just maximize the amount of action of type one. There's an interesting interior optimum that you run into, because if I put the badge too far away, and again, this is not about human psychology, well, that too, but it's about rational optimization even. Put the badge too far away, a rational optimizer will say, I'm never gonna get there. I will have left the site before I ever get it, so it has no effect on their behavior. If I put it too close in, they'll rush to get it, and they'll get it, but then I've lost control over their behavior for the whole rest of their lifetime, which is pretty long. And so it's actually finding the intermediate point, right, where I make them stretch, but not so much that they're just gonna not even try. And that actually comes out quite clearly. When you look at the objective function, it actually has this interior maximum. Yeah, Dan.
The model had delta as a constant, which seems like it affects this kind of question and also may not line up in the data.
Yeah.
Someone who has only ever done 7 actions is probably far more likely to leave than someone who's done 307
actions.
That's
true.
So you could look at, what's nice about this framework, and again, this is sort of very general framework, is you could put a different delta at every cell of this table. You could put a different P at every cell of this table. It could be that as I mature, you know, I do different things at different phases of my life. that would all be fine. Of course, the expressiveness is both a plus because I can, you know, add lots of stuff, and a minus because now it's even harder to figure out what the parameters are in the space. So I think there's an interesting algorithmic question here. I'll also mention a question that we thought about and then did some follow-up work to look at. How do badges derive their value, right? This is sort of lurking in the background. Right, we're sort of taking as given that people are trying to get these badges, but why? And there are a number of theories of why this might be. So here are three possibilities, three hypotheses that are all quite different. One is social, that I want, you know, I see other people with badges, I say, wow, these people are high status, I want to be like them. When I have those badges, people will also look up to me, right? So it's all about how people look at you when you have a badge. Motivational would say, there's a sort of, you know, if we set a goal for ourselves, then we have a motivation to try seeking, and we get satisfaction from achieving it, even if no one else sees that we have this badge. And transactional is, as the designer, I could say, when you get this badge, it will unlock certain features of the site, and now you can do stuff, and maybe that's the incentive. So we played with these two, which don't involve changing the site, in a collaboration with Coursera, actually. And this is some work that, again, Dan Urey, Ashton, and I did. working in conjunction with Coursera, they were interested in introducing badges into their forums because they wanted more forum participation on Coursera. And so they asked if we could set up some badges. And it was a chance to actually try different ways of presenting the badges to see actually what effect it would have on engagement. And so if we wanted to think about, for example, the social signal, we could say half the population just see, when they go to the forum, they just see people's names. But the other half of the population sees a little byline next to the names, which shows how many badges they've won and of what types. Right? So a strong social signal. If we want to think about the motivational mechanism, we could say on your profile, it could just say, you know, here's your current situation in the course. Or it could give you this sort of, you know, elaborate badge ladder that shows where you are on the badges and how much you need to get progress to the next one. Right? It sort of makes it very salient, your partial progress. And what we found was actually both of these presentations increase engagement on the site. Right? So if we split the population and basically A-B test these, you see increased forum engagement when you offer these. This one actually was sort of more significant engagement. Relatively small absolute effects in what we saw, but definitely increased engagement with both presentations. And actually, although it's not a randomized experiment, on the features that we badgified, way more engagement in the forum than the previous times the course had been offered. Now, granted, lots of things changed from the previous time the course was offered, but it was interesting that it was sort of precisely the ones that got badges where there was increased engagement. So again, a reflection of the fact that people will work toward these badges. Okay, so we've been thinking about, you know, badges are one thing, right? But let's sort of generalize to just long-range rewards and how people plan for them. And I want to sort of mention some more theoretical modeling that we've been doing about this kind of long-range planning activity. You know, sort of inspired by the ways in which there really is this rich design space that you can play with, and we need sort of to understand better about what are the plausible models. So what is our model thus far? You know, plans are multi-step, and the agent is choosing a sort of optimal sequence of steps given the costs and benefits that they perceive. So you know, maybe this is the whole picture. But there are certain features of human behavior that are really missing from this model, and I want to talk about one that I think is quite interesting that involves really trying to build a connection to the behavioral economics literature that really hasn't shown up in some of these algorithm design questions so far. So, all right, so people make multi-step plans. This is actually another example of a multi-step plan. If you go to the Tacoma public school system, not far from here, they take their graduation requirements, and one version is just a sort of table, but the other is this kind of pirate treasure map showing all the pitfalls you could reach along the way to get the, you know, treasure chest that is your high school diploma. And the point is, you know, stuff can happen as you go. So one reason why, you know, the plans you make you might not follow through on is that stuff actually happens. So you're going through high school and, you know, your parents lose their job and you have to somehow do something differently, or, you know, you move or whatever. So stuff could happen that you just weren't anticipating. Other things can go wrong, and that's just, you know, we could try to model exogenous factors there. But the other thing that can go wrong is that people are not consistent in their planning over time. And this is a fact that behavioral economists have really begun to delve into, and it's been sort of missing from a lot of these classical models that I've been talking about so far, right? Time and consistency. So we all know about time and consistency. Here's an example. You know, you decide you're going to get in shape. This person was in Great Britain, I guess, when they decided they wanted to get in shape. And you plunk down money for a gym membership because at last you're going to get in shape. And then you discover that, you know, you always had other stuff to do, you're busy, you didn't really feel like going there that morning, and the whole month passes and you never actually visited the gym. And you know, it wasn't like you broke your leg and couldn't do it. Circumstances had not changed. Your conditions were exactly the same as they were. You just never got around to doing it. Right? It's a kind of, and so clearly something is wrong, right? The you who didn't go to the gym is sort of the same you who put down the money to pay for the gym membership. You should not put down the money. One version of you was wrong, either the current you or the future you, because your plan was inconsistent. You spent money and didn't actually follow through on it. Okay, so this is something obviously we can observe. We can even do experiments and note it. But in the last couple decades, actually, behavioral economists have begun trying to build theoretical models of this. And I want to talk about some work that Segal Oren and I did, where we tried to delve into these models and try to create a sort of unified framework where we could ask algorithmic questions. Okay, so to talk about the origin of these models, I will tell the story of why the Nobel laureate in economics, George Akerlof, never made it to the post office. So he was on sabbatical in India. He wrote this in an American Economic Review paper. And you know, as his sabbatical was winding down, he had this giant box of stuff he had to ship back to the US, actually for a friend of his who had been there also visiting him. Now, in order to ship back the box, you know, his friend was waiting for the box, and his friend was, it was hurting his friend every day the friend didn't have it, so there was an incentive to get the box to him. But it's a pain because, you know, you have to go to the post office in India. It was sort of, you know, a long trip. You have to wait in enormous lines, fill out lots of forms. You're going to lose a whole half day. But you were going to have to do it at some point because the box had to get back to your friend. So, okay, so basically there's a one-time effort cost of C to ship it, and every day it hasn't been shipped, there's a loss of use cost X. Okay, so George Akerlof was faced with an optimization problem. If he ships it on day T, right, there are N days left to go in the sabbatical, then the cost is the one-time cost C plus TX for the all the days it wasn't used. So now you could think about, this is actually, if you think about it, not a hard optimization problem. So you'd like to min C plus TX over T between 1 and N, and that is minimized at T equals 1, right? Do it today for crying out loud. You know, just send the box. But he did something that you might recognize, I can certainly recognize from my own behavior. He procrastinated, right? So he didn't do it today. In fact, every day, it wasn't that he didn't have a plan. He had a plan. His plan was he would do it tomorrow because he understood the importance of doing it soon. But if you apply that plan inductively, then you end up waiting until day N. And of course, you have to ship it then, and you do at a significantly higher cumulative cost. There's more to the story. In fact, at some point, at roughly day N over 2, some other friends took pity on him and just brought it to the post office themselves, but that's outside the model. Okay, so, but he also did something that maybe all of us would not have done, which is he then tried to model his own behavior as simply as possible. And it's actually, and so this became the genesis of what behavioral economists refer to as quasi-hyperbolic discounting. But you can summarize it pretty simply as follows. So, here's how it works. So basically, imagine, right, so we saw discounting already, right? I'm future cost being reduced geometrically. But if I reduce cost geometrically, let me digress for a second before I read the notation here. If I reduce cost geometrically, everything is very consistent over time. Because basically it says tomorrow is like exactly like today, but just scaled down by 1 minus delta. So whatever I was going to do today looks, you know, just everything got scaled together. A different kind of discounting would be that costs incurred today in particular are more salient. They're going to be raised by a factor of B greater than 1. All future days kind of look the same to me, or they're discounted or whatever. But today is special, right? I don't want to do stuff today, because that would mean I would incur the cost right now. So on day T, suppose you just add that to the model. Well, now we have a different optimization problem. On day T, his remaining cost left in his sabbatical associated with the package, if he sends it today, is B times C, because the cost is just worse today. If he waits till tomorrow, well, OK, the loss of use cost is worse today, B times X. X is pretty small, though. Plus 1 times C, because he's not doing it today. It'll be fine tomorrow. So therefore, we just have an inequality. Tomorrow is preferable as long as C is big enough compared to X, as long as B is bigger than 1. Yeah. Everyone see that inequality? So, right, so here, think of C as like 100 and X is like 1, and B is like 2, right? So this is like 200. This is like 2 plus 100. So it's like 200 versus 102. You put the B on the small term, right? You don't want to put the B on the big term. You never want to put the B on the big term, so you always put off mailing the package. And so you just keep, and so in fact, it all makes sense, right? It's not just that he doesn't send it, but in fact, the plan of this rational, of this optimizing agent, you could debate whether they're rational, but the plan of this optimizing agent is exactly that on every day, the optimum is to send it tomorrow, right? But that's always true. Okay, so again, this became known in literature thanks to David Labson at Harvard as quasi-hyperbolic discounting. You know, that a cost reward realized to you as the future has a present value that's discounted geometrically, but also by this multiplier. Our special case is just, we'll have no geometric discounting. So the future just looks flat, except for today. Oh, and also, the other thing is the agent is naive about their own bias. So, right, so they sort of don't know that they have this problem. They don't factor it in. Okay. And the nice thing was, okay, so here was the interesting thing. The behavioral economics literature ran with this, and they can model a whole bunch of things with it. So procrastination, like we see here. Task abandonment, right? So you have this great idea that you're going to write a monograph about this topic that you know, and you get like 50 pages into it, and you just can't get around to finishing it, and it sits there. And again, you know, maybe circumstances changed, but if circumstances didn't change, then something was not rational there, because you just sank a lot of time into writing 50 pages, and that time was now wasted.
Yeah. This is, of course, something we can all relate to, because we all procrastinate.
Yeah.
But it seems to me there are a couple other factors here, and I wonder how you take them into account. One is that, in this case, I bear one of the costs, and really somebody else bears the other cost.
Yeah. Okay?
I suffer an embarrassment, but that embarrassment doesn't get any greater as time goes on. I'm not fulfilling my responsibility. The other is that when I'm not shipping the package, I'm not just sitting on my hands, I'm doing something else. And that, too, has some costs associated with deferring it. So I'm substituting one thing for another.
Yeah, that's true.
So how do you factor all this stuff together?
Okay, so let's take those in turn. So the embarrassment cost, it's sort of slightly orthogonal, as in his story happened to involve a friend of his, but let's imagine that this is, you know, a medical procedure he's putting off and the cost is to him every day he doesn't do it. The second one, yes, your substituting effort. The assumption is that, you know, if every day you're going to have roughly the same load of things that are urgent, the opportunity cost of not having done those urgent things on any day will be C. So think of C as that.
So, thank you.
Yeah, no, great questions, yeah. Everyone good with that? Right, so task abandonment, they've tried to model this way. And actually the benefits of choice reduction. If you remove people's freedom of action, you take away options, you can actually make their life better. Okay? These all come out of that. But each of these required their own little hand-engineered model to get this to work. And so what Segal and I asked was, is there a way to sort of do all these at once? Right? Is there a way to sort of have one model that sort of does all these? Another way to say this would be, you know, in the spirit of thinking about algorithms and their performance guarantees, you'd like to sort of talk about the cost ratio. You'd like to talk about, you know, the cost incurred by the present biased agent divided by the minimum cost achievable, right? That's a sort of kind of competitive ratio, approximation ratio, all the kinds of things you ask. In this case, it's sort of not the price of anarchy, as you might say in algorithmic game theory, but sort of the price of inconsistency. How bad can that get? But I don't yet quite know how to ask that question because, I mean, what question am I asking? I'm sort of saying, like, let's get together, you know, the high school story and the gym membership story and the post office story. And across all stories, what's the worst cost ratio? Like, max over all stories of, I don't know how to quantify over stories, right? I want something I can quantify over. And that was sort of our initial instigation for, we want a model where we say, over all instances of this problem, how bad can it get? Okay, so that was where we were. And we said, okay, here's an idea. Obviously, what all these stories have to do with each other is you're moving through a state space, right? Let's go back to like how we thought about Stack Overflow. There's a state space you could be in. I'm trying to get to a goal. And as I move through the state space, I incur costs. I'm trying to get the reward. So we could use graphs as kind of a basic structure to represent these scenarios. Let me tell you two versions, one with a reward, one without. So first, let's just say you're at S. You have to get to T. You must get to T. That's the goal state. And there's a shortest path problem that you face. So if I had this as a shortest path problem, I would say, well, actually, the cheapest way is over the top. 16 plus 2 plus 2 is 20. And the other ones are longer. OK, but I'm planning this as I go, and I'm time inconsistent. So really what's happening, if we think about time inconsistency, is that the first edge out is multiplied up by b. In all my examples, let's say b equals 2. Okay? So if I look at all the possible ways I could go, there are three paths through this graph. But the first one, my perceived cost is not 16 plus 2 plus 2. It's 32 plus 2 plus 2, because the 16 multiplied by 2. And it looks very unpleasant. And so in fact, I follow the edge to c. I've already left the optimum, because I don't really want to have to deal with the cost of 16 today. So I go to c, intending I'm going to go straight through. But in fact, when I get to C, I change my mind. Because from C, things look a little different. Now I'd rather go down, paying 2 times 2 plus 16 instead of 2 times 8 plus 8. Okay? And so two things have happened here. I was suboptimal, and I didn't even do what I expected I was going to do when I took the first step. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, this actually is quite an expressive model. So for example, here's George Akerlof's story drawn as a graph. Every day, he could, so state node vi now corresponds to the state of you reach day I without sending the package. Right? At the start, he could just go straight to the stupid post office. It would be all over. But he doesn't do that. He procrastinates by going to v1, at which point he could go straight to the post office and be all over. But he doesn't. He goes to v2, and he just wraps all around the cycle till he has to go to the post office. Okay? That's his story. And we can actually draw a bunch of stories, like you know the class, which could either tell you you must do one homework per week. I'll impose deadlines. Or I could tell you, here are the 8 homeworks. You're all adults. Plan your time accordingly, which is, as you know, a guaranteed disaster. By eliminating their freedom, you can actually get the homework done. In fact, I could draw a grid-like graph showing the time series of that, sort of a trellis graph, and actually show you how carving out nodes. So I can draw a bunch of stories this way. OK, let me actually tell you a bit about the deadline one. Here's version 2 of the model. In version 2, there's a reward at the end. And so you can decide whether to continue or just give up. The remaining cost has to be worth the reward you're going to get. Okay. So what happens here, for example, you look at these two options. You say, this one is a perceived cost of 2 times 2 plus 6 is 10. 2 times 3 plus 5 is 11. I'm going to go over the top route. Okay. But then you get here, and you're like, whoa, the rest of this looks like 12, no longer worth the reward at 11. And I actually give up, right? Halfway through my 100-page monograph, I stop at page 50, because just frankly, this just seems like too much effort to finish it off. And I've wasted all that cost. And the funny thing is, we already, with this graph, can sort of for free model the benefits of choice reduction, right? Rather than have to do a whole new hand-engineered model, all I have to do is observe that if I just deleted node A, you would actually complete this thing. You would actually say, well, actually, the 11, I break even, I'll do it, and I get to B, and it looks like 10, I finish. Right, so if I take away your freedom of action, right, a time-consistent agent would never, ever, this would never, ever help them. Right, for a time-consistent agent, more options are always better because they're just minimizing. Always good to minimize over more things. But for a time-inconsistent agent, taking away stuff, right, so like imposing a deadline on the homework can actually help them complete things. OK, so how bad can the cost ratio be? Let me tell you about one theorem that we proved here. So in fact, the Akerlof story is mild compared to how bad things could actually get if we start optimizing our graphs. The real bad one is almost sort of too painful to contemplate, is you procrastinated, and so you went to node v1, and now it's going to cost way more, right? But c times x plus c cubed, so if I make b roughly c, I can rig this so that the cost to go to the post office every day is getting exponentially worse. Because maybe it's not the post office, maybe it's something really unpleasant that's getting worse rapidly, right? And yet, I can always keep it right at the margin where you're just going to keep going and finally going to pay this whopping cost of c to the n at the end of all that. Okay, so it can be exponentially bad. So we asked the question, is this structure kept coming back? And the Akerlof story kept coming back. And so the question was, could we characterize instances which had this exponentially bad cost ratio, right? And here was sort of a question that we had. Informally stated, must any instance with a large cost ratio contain Akerlof's story as a substructure? Right? Is this the only way things can get really bad? Now, what's nice is, if you just ask this question, it's not clear what in the world this even means. But with graphs, we can actually say what we meant by that question. And then we're going to do that is using the theory of graph miners, which allow us to talk intelligently about substructures in big graphs. So just to kind of lay out terms here, what do I mean by a graph? So I'll say small graph H is a miner of a big graph G. If I can contract connected subsets of G into supernodes and thereby produce a copy of the small graph H. So to be concrete, I claim this graph in black has the complete graph on four nodes K4 as a miner, because I can find four connected pieces here, treat them as supernodes, and sure enough, I have a clique on four nodes. Okay? So this graph here has a K4 miner. Okay. And with that in mind, I could say, all right, so one way to talk about Akerlof's story as a substructure is say, let's take this graph which is directed and has costs. We'll abstract away from that and just say that's the undirected skeleton of it. Right? It's this thing which I'll call a K-fan, which is a path of K nodes and one node that kind of stars out to all of them. And so here's a theorem that we can actually prove, which is that, yes, actually, Akerlof's story is essential to anything where you get exponentially bad. So for every exponential-based lambda, there's some epsilon. So if the cost ratio exceeds lambda to the n, right, so if we're exponentially bad for any exponential base, then the underlying directed graph of the instance contains a K-fan minor, where K is actually linear in the size of the graph. Right? So it says any graph where things get exponentially bad, a constant fraction of that is taken up by a big copy of Akerlof's story. Right? That is the unique way, in a sense, in the structural sense, that you can actually get exponentially bad stuff. OK. There are a bunch of other questions that we asked. I'll tell you one and then move on to my final theme of this talk. So here's another question, which actually leads to, I think, is a very nice open, and I think very concrete algorithmic question, actually. Here's the question. Back to the choice reduction problem. As a designer, well, let's go back to me as the designer of the system. Right? I'm an instructor trying to create homework deadlines. I'm someone trying to help you be more personally effective by pruning options that you have. So a very concrete way to ask that is, suppose I'm given G, which is not traversable by a present biased agent, like that one up there. Is there a subgraph of G that is traversable? Right? As the designer, I just want to knock nodes out of it to make your life work better. Right? So it's a subgraph containment question. Input is G. You can't get to the end if you're present biased. Can I find a subgraph in which you could get to the end? Now we thought, OK, this won't be very hard. Because if there's some subgraph that you could traverse, presumably the smallest one will just be a path. I should just find the path you're going to follow. And I should delete everything else and just go, this is your path. Just do it. Okay? We thought that was going to be the answer. But this, the question was actually much, much harder than that. Because sometimes I can find a subgraph that gets you to the end, but there's no path that gets you to the end. Let me show you an example. Here you are at S. So the reward is 12. And from here, I actually say, I can do this. Because 2 times 2 is 4, plus the 6 up there, plus the 2. If I go over the top, I pay 12, I get 12. I'm going to make it. So I set out optimistically going from S to A. When I get to A, I realize, whoa, that's 6 times 2 is 12. That's not so good. Plus 2, I'm not worth it. But fortunately, the lower path comes to the rescue. And 2 times 3 plus 6 is actually 12. And I keep going, and I get there. Now, the problem is, if I only had the upper path, I would stop when I got to A. And if I only had the lower path, I would never start. Right? And so it's almost like, and this is not some sort of, this is a very intuitive situation, actually. Right? So if you're trying to convince, you know, a 6-year-old to take violin lessons, you know, you take them to maybe a violin concert where a virtuoso plays, and they say, wow, I could be like that person. Well, maybe. But, you know, so they start taking violin lessons. They get to note A, and they realize, you know, it's actually a lot of work to become a violin virtuoso. Not worth it. So you don't go up to B instead, but now you're underway, and you actually discover you can have a, you know, you can get a lot of enrichment in your life just by playing the violin. You take the lower path. Right? So there are lots of situations where you need the illusion of this node to actually get you underway and actually. And of course, this gets into also things like, you know, so is the designer actually basically deceiving people to get them to move on? And there are all sorts of interesting questions here about, you know, what's reasonable behavior and what's not. And you can actually formalize some of those, right? That maybe you should only introduce modifications that are still benefit, you know, in enhancing for the person. Okay, so this was a much harder problem than we thought. We did have a theorem characterizing the structure of minimal traversable graphs. And then actually a bunch of people have followed up on this model, including Uri Feige, who took an interest in it over the summer, and showed actually it's actually NP-complete to determine if G has a traversable subgraph. So it's actually quite hard to figure out, can you pare down to a core that you can actually traverse? But there are some very nice open questions. Maybe the simplest one to state, and I'll just state that one, is can you get an approximation to this? Right? So what would an approximation mean? That for some small factor, I bump up the reward and I delete nodes. Right? So if this graph is traversable, then there's a way for me in polynomial time to find a small increase in the reward and a traversable subgraph with that greater reward. Right? Kind of a two-mode approximation. Okay, so I promised I would come back to this issue of incentives torquing behavior and carry it all the way back to the offline world. And let me talk a little bit about, you know, incentives and scientific output, and I'll talk briefly about this. This was actually the first time that Segal and I thought about sort of incentives, long-range planning, and how it torques behavior. So this is from a couple years ago, but it's part of this theme that, right, we do this too, right? Let's forget the online world, let's forget badges, let's forget virtual badges. Let's think about science really as a model environment that has systems of rewards, right? There are lots of rewards we strive for. We want our papers to get accepted, we want our grant proposals to get funded, we'd like to get hired, we'd like our students to get hired, you know, we look at who receives awards. All of these are effectively badges of some sort. Now, some affect your actual livelihood, like being hired, so maybe you want to cross that one out. But a lot of these, you know, your salary is very immaterially affected by whether your next conference paper got in. You care about it much more than the monetary compensation would look like. Now, sure, there's a lot of decentralization here, but actually science is also interesting because when we talk about the designer, you know, science is much more of a planned economy than you think, right? You literally can find, you know, in the actual economy, it's very hard to find committees of people sitting around deciding what the price of milk should be. You know, I mean, you can find approximations of that. In science, you very much do find people sitting around tables at conference program committees saying, should we accept this paper or that paper, and what message will it send to people about what they should be working on? I've been in untold numbers of those conversations, right? And so you actually find this kind of designed planning. So, you know, people are actually taking the incentive effects of their decisions into account exactly with these things. They understand that they're levers. And it was sort of with that in mind that this piece of mail showed up in my inbox about 6 years ago, signed by a really esteemed bunch of theoretical computer scientists who were concerned. Some of you may have seen this on blogs. This is a screenshot from Scott Aronson's blog where it got reproduced. Concerned that this is the CS theory community had been sort of over-rewarding technical contributions and was sort of under-rewarding conceptual contributions, right? That effectively the wrong things are being valued in the community, and this is a problem. We should do something about it. And they mailed me, and I'll confess, they asked, you know, would you sign on with us? And I said, and I meant at the time, this is a tricky question. I need to think about this. And then I missed my chance to sign it, so I went out without me. And I meant that. I needed to think about it. And that was 2008. And finally, Segal and I wrote this paper in 2011, which was sort of the outcome of us, you know, thinking about it. Because it seemed like I mean, this is not about the theory community. You know, every community I've ever talked to, you know, systems, AI, PL, you know, NA, all of these complain about this, that, you know, the wrong things are being valued. There's something robust about it. And if it's robust, it must be happening for a reason. Well, so you start looking into the literature, and actually there are sort of these two pathologies people talk about. And let me say what they are. So the one that this letter is signed by this blue ribbon set of theoreticians was about, you know, which raised some very deep questions, is that certain research questions seem to receive an unfair amount of credit, right? That progress on some questions is heavily rewarded, even when the community has common knowledge that there are other things that seem equally valuable. And often, the sort of nature of the skew is based on sort of the technical difficulty, right? The sort of technical things. That was sort of the nature of the argument. Now, there's a second one, which they didn't explicitly talk about, but you can also hear people talk about. And this is Robert Merton's famous Matthew effect, which he articulated in the 1960s, that when two people do a joint discovery or two people independently do a discovery, the more famous one tends to get more of the credit. Okay, so two people do the same thing, and one of them sort of gets an outsized share. And this is named the Matthew effect, not because basically because of the book of Matthew in the New Testament of the Bible, which basically contains the sentence that they that have shall get more, and they that have very little will lose even that, basically, in translation. Right, and so he was quoting that from the book of Matthew. Both of these are going on. Now, in fact, this is sort of a two-sided thing, right? If I think about what is going on in science, I'm pairing up people with the problems they work on. It says that unfairness is operating on both sides of the market. It's operating on the right-hand side with the problems you're choosing. It's operating on the left-hand side with the people who are choosing them. Now, maybe this is, again, just a story of people and their biases, and it's just life is unfair. But maybe there's something else going on. And so, again, we wanted to sort of delve into this and say, is there a model that helps us understand qualitatively that these are really robust things? So for that, we have to first ask, why do incentives happen in science? Why give out scientific credit? Why value these things? And, there's been a long argument that scientific credit creates incentives, right? So it causes people to distribute their effort over different research problems. And I'll indulge briefly in the Matthew effect by pointing out that, there are at least two Nobel laureates in this list who've thought about this, Ken Arrow and Eric Maskin, and then all those other people up there, too. So, but actually, probably my favorite piece of writing about this is actually by the French cultural philosopher Pierre Bourdieu, who did a lot of the early work on social capital, for example, who phrased it this way, which sort of, I think, describes it nicely, that research and motivations are organized by reference to anticipation of, symbolic profits, right? And what they do is they concentrate on problems regarded as the most important ones. The intense competition triggered off likely bring out a fall in the average rate of profit if you work on these really highly competed for problems, and hence the departure of a fraction of researchers toward other objects which are less prestigious but around which the competition is less intense so that they offer profits of at least as great, right? You move on to these less popular problems because it just got too crowded there. Actually, for a French cultural philosopher, kind of a really nice statement of like load shedding in a distributed system, right? Just too much is there, and then we're going to move on to this other thing. Okay, now this all got taken and actually turned into a nice model for how scientists choose problems by the philosopher of science, Philip Kitcher. And when we thought about it, his model had a bunch of bells and whistles that we didn't need. He was really thinking about like natural scientists who were doing experiments looking for evidence for sort of natural theories. We were sort of thinking about its sort of original formulation in that email as sort of hard open math problems that you could choose to work on. So let's think about it that way. So how's this going to work? And I'll show you this one model, and then we'll just wrap up with some reflections and be done. So here's how it works. So I have researchers and I have problems. On the left, researchers A, B, C, and D. On the right, three problems, X, Y, and Z they could choose to work with. In this very simple model, because again, I would like the simplest, if I can get this sort of human unfairness to emerge from a very simple model, it'll suggest a certain conceptual robustness to it. So we're going to try and make this very simple. Each open math problem has two parameters. It has an importance. And crucially, because I want the unfairness to be very stark, everyone is going to agree on how important this problem is. Right? This is not going to arise because of differences in taste. We all agree how important it is. That's the weight, Wx. And then it has a difficulty, F sub x, which stands for failure. That is your probability of failing when you try to work on it. You try, but you just didn't succeed. And so researchers are going to pick problems. And the way they do that is they pick a problem. A and B picked X. They pick up a coin labeled X. They flip it. And with probability F sub X, they fail. And probably 1 minus F sub X, they succeed. And they've thereby accomplished an importance of Wx. That's how it works. So each person's going to pick a problem to work on. And so it's a game, right? It's a simultaneous move, multiplayer game, one shot. We're all going to pick a problem to work on. Okay. And so we need to figure out what's our payoff, what's the benefit to society, and then what do I mean by Nash equilibrium? So, well, here's society's benefit from all the problems that get worked on. Well, for each project J, I will get a benefit of WJ if someone succeeds. And for someone to succeed, they shouldn't all fail, so that's the expression. Right? That's them all, not all failing, and that's the word. Now, the benefit to a player is, well, if they're one of the KJ people who does it, here's the expected reward from that project, and someone's going to do it first. It could be them, right? So we're adding one more feature to the model that if KJ people all work on it, one of them does it first. And finally, a Nash equilibrium would say that's a Nash equilibrium if even looking at what everyone's doing, no one has an incentive to change the problem they're working on. All right, let me walk you through an example and see if we can reproduce some of the effects we were talking about. So here's a world with two researchers, two problems. Again, simple enough example, we can do it by hand. So the first problem has an importance of 1 and a probability of 1/2. The second problem is actually a slightly less important problem, and it's harder. Right? It has a weight of 9/10, and there's only a 1/3 chance you're going to do it right. You're going to solve it. Okay. So on the left is the Nash equilibrium. The two people compete over the more important, easier problem. I mean, it seems reasonable. And you can work out the math. Each player is getting, well, there's a 3/4 expected benefit from that. One of them will get it. So they get a payoff of 3/8 here if you work through the math. Right? So, whereas if you switch, then you're all alone on project Y, which you do with 1/3 getting 9/10, so you get 3/10. But 3/10 is less than 3/8. Neither of them wants to switch to the smaller problem, right? They're both competing over this one, and they're both happy they're competing over this one. But society is not happy, because society would actually get a higher, currently society is getting 3/4 this way. But if they were to separate, society would get a half from the top one, 3/10 from the bottom one, that's 4/5, it's better than 3/4. I mean, that's fine. Like, the world is full of examples where the Nash equilibrium is not socially optimal. So, you know, although it's interesting that, you know, people are kind of allocating their effort incorrectly, it's not necessarily news. What's interesting here, though, is, again, this is a planned economy to some extent. So suppose you were in charge of the world. Could you do something about this bad state of affairs? And the answer is, yes, you could. You could actually declare that, well, you know, actually, we're going to decide that if you solve the lower problem, your reward will be 6/5. We understand the importance is 9/10, but we're going to inflate the credit you get to 6/5. And what's going to happen now, actually, is that now the unique Nash equilibrium in the system is socially optimal. Right, I've gotten people to do the right thing as the designer of the system. And how did I get the people to do the right thing? I did it by being intentionally unfair, right? By taking the harder, less important problem and artificially inflating its credit. And note the weirdness, right? We're not suffering from a mass delusion. The community still agrees that X is the more important problem. It's just that if they're trying to optimize their productivity to the outside world, they need to create this artificial currency internally in which they reward apparently the wrong things, right? Okay. So that's sort of, that was the starting point. And we actually do this with the Matthew effect also. We could say, for example, again, we're stuck in this bad Nash equilibrium. Instead of rigging the right-hand side, I'll rig the left-hand side. I'll say, here's A versus B, and you two are identical researchers, but because A, you know, went to a more prestigious school, or they're, you know, somehow more attractive or whatever, A is going to have a higher relative share of credit than B. So if the two of you compete, then I'm actually going to give and you both solve it. I'm going to give credit to A with probably 5/6 and B with 1/6 and not 50-50. I'm just going to make life unfair. Well, now B decides it's not worth competing with A, and B goes off and works on problem Y, and perversely, social welfare has gone up. Right? By unfairly scaring researcher B away from it, things have gotten better. So it's a kind of Matthew effect. Obviously, fame is not part of our model, but if this were their relative fame, 5 versus 1, B would be scared off from competing with A, and they would just go do something else. Okay, so we looked at this, and actually these are worked examples to show you what we had in mind, but we proved some theorems. In particular, you can actually now prove theorems that for any instance of this problem, a set of players, a set of projects, difficulties, importances, there always exists a reweighting of the projects so that all Nash equilibrium is socially optimal, and there always exists a reweighting of the players, right? So you can either use unfair allocation of credit, you can also use the Matthew effect, and you can always get social optimality. Okay, so here are some just thoughts on what this tells us, and then I'll wrap up. Happy to take questions. So first of all, reweighting of the projects. So Pierre Bourdieu, who described people being scared off from the intense competition and going to look at less contentious projects, he was right in principle, but the problem is that effect is not working optimally, right? So here there's intense competition. Society would benefit if people were scared off, but it's not enough competition to scare them off. So the problem is it's not optimally balanced, and sort of the world needs help balancing it. Similarly, reweighing the players is even more sort of weird, and kind of it's sort of this weird controversial point that what is it saying if you just interpret the math? It says by unfairly marginalizing certain people, by telling them if you do this, we're just not going to take that as seriously as if someone else does it. By marginalizing them, you're forcing them to embark on higher risk activities, which are ultimately benefiting social welfare, right? Is that a good thing? Are we happy that that's true? No. I mean, it seems kind of unfair. But it is what's happening in this model. And it's, therefore something to ask whether we actually see evidence of that happening in in real life, right? In the sense that none of these are design recommendations so much as just observations about what's happening robustly in these kinds of systems. And finally, one intriguing thing that we saw as we played around with this, there were a bunch of intriguing effects, a community size effect that for the very same set of projects, if I add more and more identical players to the system, the equilibria start changing. And in particular, the optimal allocation of credit you have to do starts changing. And the rough direction it goes is that as communities get more crowded, as I add more players, I have to reward more and more and more the kind of hard, less important problems. Right? So as communities get more crowded, in effect, they become more obsessed with the kind of with the hard problems. And that's happening just out of the model. A whole bunch of questions you could ask here, right? I haven't, for example, talked about collaboration. How should we divide credit between people? I haven't talked about dependence among the projects, right? Maybe it's the initial step doesn't get as much credit as the last step, or vice versa. And of course, dynamic arrival of projects. A product shows up, we don't quite know how hard it is until we try it out. So all of these are interesting sort of things that you could ask here. But more generally, again, as in all the other examples I've been showing you, the conferral of rewards, in this case, symbolic rewards like status, are becoming part of the design space. Okay, and so in the end, that's roughly what I had to say about incentives and how they steer behavior. I think all modeling activity, you know, involves a kind of bending of reality where you start with this colorful Foursquare page full of badges, and you ask, hey, what's going on here? And you end up with pictures of state spaces and pictures of flows through them. And that's sort of been the kind of attempt here to think about how can we conceptualize what's going on with something that a priori looks messy and involves human behavior. How can we try to impose certain models on it to get qualitative ideas of what's going on? I think there's a bunch more to be said about various questions, and I'll just pick out three of these. One is this question about, you know, where does the value reside in these rewards, and this sort of teasing apart of the social, the motivational, the transactional aspects, and many others. Right, how these different mechanisms for value affect the design, and in particular, if people have a mixture of motivations. Some are interested in the social status aspects, some are interested in the transactional aspects. How do we design for an ensemble? Computational models incorporating human behavioral biases like time and consistency, I think we're really only scratching the surface of what one can do. And there's really a large and growing literature in behavioral economics that's really, you know, moved beyond the stage of just intriguing experiments and is beginning to formalize a lot of these things. I think it's really ripe for theoretical ideas and computational ideas to come in. And I think as we think about these systems that we design and the consequences, sometimes intended, sometimes unintended, of the incentives that we introduce, I think the kind of algorithmic and computational ideas that, you know, we as a community can bring to bear are going to play a crucial role in all of these questions going forward. Thanks very much.
A couple of questions, and then we have a reception in the atrium. Please join us for that. Way back.
So in one of your slides, you mentioned that when the communities get more crowded, you have like more competition for hard questions. Was it that there is naturally more competition, or you need to make those questions?
So the argument I was making, and again, we haven't quite formalized exactly how this works, but you can create families of examples where it basically says that you need to put more and more artificial reward on the hard questions.
Got it.
Something the designer has to do to keep people spread out. Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Seems like one of the problems for scientific publishing is that the rewards for working on a certain problem are sort of tied to how many people are working on it. So
yeah,
because you'll get a lot more citations if you work on, if you publish a paper in some area that a lot of people are publishing on.
Yeah, interesting question. Yeah.
So I wonder if that's something you consider modeling.
Yeah, it's a nice question. So basically, I think that's the sort of, we thought about a bunch of questions where I say dependence among projects. That will become an issue, especially if this is not a one-shot game, but a multi-stage game where future projects are going to build on this one. So if I do that, now a bunch of people are now going to be trying to follow up on me. And so I think turning this into a multi-stage game, which we've thought about a little bit, is a very, very interesting question. Yeah.
Question.
One more.
So your expression for the social utility of an outcome was independent of the actual utility of any of the scientists who are doing the work. Do you have any idea how adding an effect for that would limit?
Yeah, it's actually the sum. If you think about it, it's actually, so the benefit to society is also the same as the sum of the benefits to all the scientists, right? So in that sense, the market clears, right? Because someone's going to get all the sort of, in the version where I don't have artificial credit, right? This is with the true native credit of the problem, the real weight. Once I introduce artificial credit, then everything starts getting messed up.
Right. So would that tend to tamper the amount of artificial credit that I'm willing to give out?
I mean, there's going to be some limit, right? So when I give out artificial amounts of credit, clearly I can create instances where the correct credit allocation, where the you know, real one, the WIs, is it actually works. Right, so, and another interesting question would be sort of how do I characterize those instances where life is fair? And then you could also ask like how torqued can things get, but the example with the increasingly crowded community, basically, there is a family example that says things can get sort of arbitrarily unfair as the community grows.
Okay, please join us in the atrium. You can corner John with more questions there, and let's thank him one more time.
Thanks again.